for the portal. With the visible sector, we have the direct detection, indirect detection, and collider production. But the question that I'm very interested in is that, how about the complementary to the active search about the portal? That is, can we extract the information about the self-interaction with the dark sector directly without relying on the specific form of the dark portal? So by doing that, we gain a few benefits. For example, we can remain agnostic about the production mechanism of the dark matter. So it doesn't have to be thermally produced. It can be produced through, for example, misalignment if it's light. And we can extract the information. If we extract the information about the self-interaction directly, we sort of break the degeneracy of the probe that relies on the portal. If we only use the probe to infer the structure of the dark matter, then what we observe actually is the self-interaction combined with the portal, because we observe everything through the portal. If we can somehow extract information with the self-interaction directly, we sort of break the degeneracy. Yes.
I understand what you're saying here. So you want to probe dark matter coupling?
Yes.
Okay.
Without the using the portal, without assuming any dark matter standard model portal.
Ah, okay.
That's what we try to do.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. And there's one last benefit, that is we can go beyond the range of the direct detection. We can go beyond the GeV to TeV range. Okay, and in order to do that, we need to have something that we know for sure definitely couples to dark sector, which is gravity. Okay. So to put it in a more concrete context, what I mean is that depending on the spin of the dark matter particle and what it talks to, we usually classify that into these four portals. We have the dark photons, axion-like particles, dark scalars, and the fermionic dark matter, which is also sometimes called the stellar neutrino, if it couples to neutrino. Then for the dark scalar and the fermionic dark matter, the collider experiments and neutrino experiments, they are very sensitive to it for the portal couplings. And for the dark photons and axion-like particles, the indirect detection, and also the fifth fourth bound they apply. So what I'm trying to do is that suppose that we have the self-interaction without assuming any portal, and what extent does it affect the gravitational wave events? Okay, first let's take the dark photon and the fermionic dark matter as an example. Let's write down the generic Lagrangian. So chi is the fermionic dark matter. They interact through each other with each other through this dark photon, and that's the kinetic energy of the dark photon. And this is our assumption. We assume that for the neutron star mergers, suppose each neutron star, they have some amount of this asymmetric dark matter. So from that, they gain some charge, some dark charge. And the question we try to address is that to what extent it affects the neutron star merger. To answer that question, let's first draw a line of the mass of the force carrier, that's the dark photon. And we have a few scales here. First, we have the 10 kilometer inverse, which is about 10 to the minus 11 eV. And anything, if the dark photon is heavier than this, the interaction is confined within each neutron star.
Oh, but sorry.
Yes.
I mean, what does dark matter have to do with neutron stars?
We assume that the neutron stars, they accumulate dark matter. They have already accumulated some fraction of dark matter through the history after they form.
How?
Through sweeping through the dark matter region, maybe the dark matter cloud.
So there is an interaction between the, because if you just have gravitational, it's not enough.
Right. So the dark matter has to radiate energy when they fall into the neutron star. And we didn't quite study that accumulation process carefully, but we assume that they have already accumulated some amount of asymmetric dark matter.
How much?
That's the part we try to constrain. The fraction we try to constrain together with the coupling.
But how then can you make, I mean, you're not making, I mean, now you're saying you're going to do something that does not care about the coupling to the standard model, but now you're assuming that there's something that accumulated in neutron stars, which is highly non-trivial.
Yes.
So then it's not model independent, whatever you're going to do. So well, it doesn't care about, so it's very sensitive to how dark matter got there.
Yeah, actually, they can be accumulated through the dark photon radiation. And also, we remain agnostic about the accumulation, but
with the dark photon radiation.
For example, when the neutron star sweeps through a dark matter cloud,
yeah,
they can be trapped into this gravitational well. And when they fall into the radiated wave energy through the dark photon.
Okay, but then the interaction between the dark photon between two dark matter particles is repulsive because you only have one charge.
Yes, exactly.
So then why do you accumulate enough?
Yes, that's actually a very good point because when we put bound on it, we do need to keep that in mind. If it accumulates too much, indeed it cannot accumulate more. And for our analysis, it shows that it does have it can accumulate enough to generate the gravitational wave signal while without violating this trivial bound. So for the force bound, that's like a trivial bound. If it's too much, then it repels.
Yeah, right? There's a loop repulsion.
Yes, right. We did keep that in mind.
Oh, okay.
So literally,
thanks. Yeah.
Okay, go.
So literally, you have some asymmetric chi abundance.
Yes.
A bunch of dark protons or whatever, like all positive.
Yes.
Say. And then you have a dark photon with some mass that you presume to be very small.
Yes.
So of Compton wavelength, at least comparable to the proton neutron star also.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So they have a reasonably long range interaction. Certainly mm-hmm. it's a weak enough, it's a small enough mass to allow for these things to be radiated and dissipate.
Yes,
and,
that's right.
So the very regime where you have dissipation is also the regime where you have the long range interaction. And then literally you have a bunch of these, it's almost like the Thomson-Plum putting model. You have a bunch of these positive guys flying around, gravitationally bound.
Yes.
And then that's going to give you the effect that you're looking for.
Yes, that's right. That is the source of this asymmetric dark charge of each neutron star. But it's only, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this, but it's only one way to give the neutron star dark charge. There are other ways. So here we use the asymmetric dark matter, but actually in scalar tensor theory, you can also have give the neutron star dark scalar charge. And I'm going to briefly mention that in the end. Okay. And we try to construct the model through asymmetric dark matter here first. Okay, other questions? All right, so yeah, we have talked about this. If it's heavier than this, it's, the interaction is confined within each neutron star. So it's not directly relevant for the merger system. Of course, it can still affect the equation of state, for example, but that's like a extra piece of information we are not considering at this moment. And so if it's very light, suppose it's lighter than 10 to the minus 22 EV, is heavily constrained by the large scale structure, and we are not considering that either. So that leaves us a range of the dark photon mass from 10 to the minus 22 EV to 10 to the minus 11 EV, more than 10 orders of magnitude. And in this region, we divided into two regions with 600 kilometer. We call it region one, region two. 600 kilometer, that is the initial separation of the two neutron stars when the signal first comes into the LIGO window. Okay, let's look at these two regions one by one. For region one, we have a, so for region one, because of this dark interaction sourced by asymmetric dark matter in each neutron star, it's a correction of the Newtonian potential. And because this force carrier is massive, we have actually a eukaryotic potential on top of this Coulomb potential. And if we solve the differential equation, P is the gravitational wave radiation power, and E is the potential, we get the merger evolution during this process. And in the beginning, when the separation is large, this potential is suppressed by the mass of the mediator. So in the beginning, the two neutron stars, they don't feel the dark force of each other. And when they approach each other, this interaction is becomes effective, because when R is small, this goes to almost a Coulomb potential. So when it's small, it's like a correction to the Newton potential, gravity potential.
Question. Yes. I'm imagining this right now, and like, it's not like the dark matter is nailed to the neutron star. It's purely gravitationally bound,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So really what you have is you have two gravitational wells mm-hmm. that are reasonably far apart,
mm-hmm.
600 kilometers or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then there's a cloud
mm-hmm.
in each of them that is in that well. Now those clouds repel each other or whatever with that Yukawa force. But in my mind, that's very different from the neutron stars repelling each other from that Yukawa force, because what's going to happen is those clouds are going to separate.
Yeah.
And they might also, you know, so there's some weirdo, you know what I mean,
exactly.
Right?
No, I know exactly. I mean, this is the confusing part. What is the distribution?
So is that you assume the dark matter is nailed to the neutron star?
Yeah.
That's a good point. Actually, so right now, Joe Bramanti and I are considering to what extent these two dark cores, they can be fixed within the neutron star. And for this part, I said this is totally independent of the portal. But actually, for this requirement, it does require some drag force
right.
of the neutron star
right.
Between the neutron and the dark matter
right.
particles.
Right.
And if the interaction between these two are too small, they can be dislocated.
Yeah.
And so from here, actually, we can put bound on the cross-section between the neutron and the dark matter for them to be fixed.
You're reintroducing the degeneracy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, continue. No, you're right. I mean,
the whole point was you wanted to split the degeneracy between standard model dark matter interaction and dark matter dark matter interaction. But now you're telling me that if I can turn off your signal
mm-hmm.
by either turning off the dark matter interaction or by turning off the dark matter standard model interaction, because if the dark matter standard model interact,
mm-hmm.
then the dark matter is slippery. The neutron stars are going to go wee, and the still piece of dark matter is just going to stay outside. So,
okay.
Or is it? Maybe I'm
yeah.
too naive. Like, I don't know.
No, it's a good point.
I don't understand what is the distribution of dark matter in the neutron star.
Okay.
Why, as they come closer, why does it stay? Yeah, how does it?
Yeah, evolve? Because like the gravitational potential,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I forget. Maybe what's the gravitational potential instead of a uniform sphere? I think it's like linearly with
yeah.
radius, right? So it's
yeah.
like
mm-hmm.
linearly with radius, and then it does the 1/r² thing. So like, it's okay, it's
mm-hmm.
a pretty steep potential. And like, there's some simple sanity check that you can do where if you assume it's only held in by this linear potential, right? It's a completely trivial classical mechanics calculation to see whether how the system responds. I mean,
okay. So for that, I have a few words to say.
Okay.
So based on the equation of state of the neutron star simulation, actually, unless you have a very large fraction of the dark matter that you can form a dark matter cloud,
uh-huh.
then they are actually bound within the surface.
Oh, sure, but
okay.
within the surface, the potential is whatever it is.
Right. Okay, so, and for this computation, what we are going to look into is the merge process before it reaches ISCO. Before it reaches innermost stable circular orbit.
No, but the question is the following. If
yeah.
the cloud of dark matter
uh-huh.
has a certain distribution,
yeah.
but it's bound gravitationally to the neutron star.
Mm-hmm.
So why, as the neutron stars, as they come closer, don't the cloud just stay put and repel each other?
Okay, because we are only considering not the cloud, but bounded within the surface of the neutron star.
But I don't understand what it means you're assuming. You told me, you presented a model.
Uh-huh.
The model
yeah.
is that there is the only interaction with the standard model is gravitational.
Yes.
So for that, you should have, there is no way you can make assumptions. You know how the dark
well,
matter
I mean,
yeah. Right. So for that, I agree. I should not say that we take the portal to be zero. We remain agnostic about the portal, but the portal is not so small that it's zero.
Because there's a really simple way.
What? Well, yeah, you can, yes, but I think that the...
Okay.
Here's a simple question, With, if this dark matter is within the neutron star, there's two forces acting on it, right? This is classical mechanics.
Yeah.
The force between the neutron star center of gravity and this guy, and the force between, so take a single charge X inside the neutron star, and it's some characteristic distance away, what is the force that this guy feels towards the center of the neutron star? Yeah, whatever it is, it's very, very simple. And then what is the force between this X and the entire charge cloud over there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And which and if you know, and if the if and the only requirement here is that the gravitational force on X is bigger than the force of the charge cloud on X.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So that's a trivial condition to check.
Yeah.
If the gravitational force is greater than that, then it's okay.
Right.
So that
indeed. We are looking at we are comparing this with G Newton and 1M2. So these are the two masses of the neutron stars. These are the dark charge of the neutron stars.
No, that's not the right thing to compare. So the right thing to compare, because the dark matter is not it's attached gravitationally to the neutron star. Is the gravitational force from the neutron star to a single dark matter particle versus the repulsive force for the other particles that comes, but that's not.
Oh. For a single particle, so we should put M and the dark charge of a single particle, right? And if this is one, that's the bound you are talking about. It cannot be accumulated. M2 is the neutron star mass. Because if the bound is larger than one, you cannot accumulate.
Sorry, It's not that ratio.
The force ratio is literally mx m neutron star over r1 G Newton.
Yeah.
Well,
that
was it, I think.
Well,
it doesn't.
Whatever it's linear, whatever it is,
some function of r, whatever it is in there, versus, right, r1 versus. You know, mx, I mean, the potential, exponent, blah, 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 r2.
Yes.
Yeah, you're comparing the electrostatic repulsion of this guy versus there's a cloud of x acting on this x.
Mm-hmm.
That force has to be smaller than the gravitational force between this and this.
Yeah.
In order for this to be lodged in tight and affect the neutron star.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's
so
right.
Is that something that was enforced in the analysis?
Yes, it is.
Ah,
right. It is.
Okay. This is what we want.
Okay, sorry. I always think about the single neutron star. Thank you for clarifying that.
So this is, it is nailed to the neutron star without the need of a drag force.
Right. For the other neutron star, yes. It doesn't drag it out.
So what? So there's no need for drag force.
So there's no need to add a standard interaction between the model and the dark matter.
For the drag force, I was referring to something slightly different.
Oh, okay.
Because for this merge process, for the dark clump, actually they receive extra force, right? So basically it's just Gm equal to r omega square. And for this neutron star, this holds. But since they are rotating at the same radius with same angular moment, angular velocity, but for this dark clump, they receive extra force. So to stabilize that part.
Extra force from what?
Extra force from the other clump.
Okay. Yes.
In order to keep them synchronized.
Tidal separation.
Exactly. Oh. I was talking about this, sorry. To keep them in location, we need some drag force. And that's the thing that we are considering right now.
But I mean, isn't that a sort of almost similar question?
Let's see.
Isn't it a similar question? Because it's essentially, again, the thing that nails it in place is the rotational potential internally versus the extra radial force which comes from the charge cloud.
Yeah.
Isn't that essentially a similar question?
Yeah.
It's a question of how nailed in place the thing is due to being in this deep gravitational well of the neutron star.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
So it's a question.
Yes. So for this part, that our understanding is that the interaction between the neutrons and the dark core it cannot be totally zero.
Oh, you need to add something.
We need, still need something, but for a large range, they can be localized. So to put it this way, suppose we have this G prime QQ over G Newton MM. And that is the cross-section between the neutron and the dark matter. So when this cross-section is very, very small, then they cannot be keeping position.
And this is the tidal distortion, essentially.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
For this region, there's some relation between these two. But when this is large enough, we estimated this, if it's larger than minus 47 centimeters square for this, then it's independent of the cross-section. So we only need some amount of interaction to keep them in location. And after that, we can forget about the interaction between the neutron and the dark matter. But when the interaction is so small, I agree, for a certain region, we need to worry about whether to keep them in location. OK? All right. OK, good. So all right. So with the quadrupole radiation, we have the time evolution with the separation. R is the radius between the two neutron stars. And if we only consider the quadrupole radiation in the beginning, we are here. The separation is about 600 kilometers. And as time goes, the separation decreases, and the time goes up. This is in a certain rescaled unit. And in the end, they merge.
What is T? Sorry.
T is the time. T is the time after the signal emerges in the window. Right. It's in a weird unit. So forget about the unit of T, but R is in kilometer. So this is just the quadrupole radiation. And if we add the Yukawa correction to it, so in the beginning, there's no correction to the merge time. And after the signal switches on, there's a correction. So this blue curve is just a correction. There's a correction of time as the function of separation. And once the signal is switched on, it can be actually mimicked by a correction of the Coulomb potential. So if it's switched on, it looks as if that we are correcting the mass of the merger. And in the beginning, there's nothing, because they don't feel the interaction. And depending on the mass of the force carrier, this can be switched on either early or late. If the force carrier is heavy, then it's switched on late. And if the force carrier is light, it's switched on early. And obviously, if it's very light, then in the beginning, when the signal comes into the LIGO window, the force is already there. They can feel the force sourced by the asymmetric dark matter. So this is degenerate with the pure gravity.
But in each of these cases, the yellow curve is for a different mass than the real mass. It's
exactly.
Fakes at best. Right. But the fake mass and the real mass get closer and closer as you bring the Yukawa force down.
Right, right. Yes, that's right. So actually, besides that, they get closer, actually. So actually, the fake mass appears only after the distance gets smaller. So when to this limit, when the force carrier is very light, the fake mass is there in the beginning. So you cannot tell the switch on effect. OK. And so now we are here at the end, at the limit of region one. So to summarize with one sentence, we are correcting the potential with a Yukawa potential that's from the dark force. Okay. And that affects the merger waveform. For region two, because the force is the carrier is very light, so for this part, it's no longer a step-like function. We can actually combine the two Coulomb potential that's degenerate. But actually, we have only corrected the potential, the energy part. So there is a left-hand side part of this equation that we haven't touched upon. So we know that for electromagnetic radiation, the electric dipole, that's the leading radiation. And same here, it's the same thing for the dark photon. And for the dark photon, actually, it also has, because of the presence of the dark photon, it has a correction of the radiation power. So for the dipole, case that's with dark photon, the leading term of the radiation is to the dipole radiation that's proportional to r to the r square. And for pure gravity case, the leading term is the quadrupole.
If, wait, I mean, there's
yes.
Something confuses me in this statement. So if you don't have a lot of mass inside the neutron stars, it should be that, yeah, so the power, so you're talking about the decay of the orbit now.
Yes.
So
yeah, you can call it the decay of the orbit. It's an extra channel to radiate away the energy, the binding energy between the two neutron stars.
The mass of the dark matter is very little. No matter how strong the coupling is to the photon, it shouldn't matter if it's attached to the.
You want to say that if we radiate away all the dark matter energy, is still small enough?
Yeah, so this is what, yeah, I'm trying, I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here, basically, because, I mean, you understand my confusion?
So how many mass of dark matter do you have in the neutron star you need to assume? What's the minimal amount?
Yeah, what's the minimal amount?
So in this case, in the end, we did the analysis. It turns out to be, it can be smaller than 1%.
That's allowed by Coulomb repulsion?
Yeah.
But how big is the coupling between the, how is the cage coupling? How big is the cage coupling?
Yeah, I can show you the constraint.
Okay,
let's
continue because, right. I mean, you understand my confusion, yeah. Right? I mean, it has to do with, if there is not a lot of dark matter,
uh-huh.
It will be just dragged along with the dynamics of the system are just determined by the neutron star motion. And no matter how much dipole radiation you radiate,
yeah.
It's like we send a guy in space and we shoot a laser on Earth and we try to push the Earth. I mean, nothing will happen to the Earth. I mean, there must
be. If the fraction is too small, then
exactly.
The radiation is not important.
It won't affect the trajectory of the neutron star. It would be like.
Yeah, I agree. If the fraction is too small, indeed. Even if we throw away all the energy, it doesn't affect.
Yeah,
much.
Exactly.
Right.
So there must be some.
That's a good point. Yes.
There must be some transition somewhere where this happens, where the. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Because
yes.
Here these formulas just assume that you, whatever energy you radiate, modified significantly the
orbit.
Yeah.
Behavior.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
Which is not clear to me.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, we do need to worry about the amount of dark matter confined.
Okay, continue.
And X probably, what is X in the final form?
Oh, okay, it's a combination of a lot of things,
right,
a lot of parameters. Yeah, I mean, for X, I can show you, it's in the paper, but it's a combination of the Newtonian and also the mass profile of the merger. Okay.
So probably that's where it's taken into account.
Yeah, it's a shorthand for a combination.
Okay,
of,
let's continue.
Yeah. Okay, so after we add the dipole moment, we have a different T dependence of the frequency. So with the quadrupole, we have this frequency versus time is the characteristic T to the 3/8 for the quadrupole radiation. And if we add this, then there's no way for us to mimic this effect with pure gravity case.
So just to understand this a bit better, you're saying, so now you're
imagining a dipole.
Zero is the merger, or zero is, zero is, what's the T of zero? What's zero?
This zero is the time that the signal enters the
LIGO band.
So, yes. And it goes this way, and the frequency goes up.
So the fact that there's now an extra electrostatic repulsion between them, it changes the frequency.
Sorry?
I see. So it arrests how close they can.
So what's the confusion?
Happens faster?
Yeah, because the extra channel of the radiation. Right. So in this plot, we are considering the extra dipole radiation. It is an extra channel.
So it doesn't spin up so high because energy loss is more efficient per spin sort of thing. So it doesn't have to spin as fast to get rid of all its energy. So the collapse happens at a lower frequency.
Actually, my take of this is that the high frequency is reached early. So it's like the merge duration is shorter.
Right.
I mean, it's the same thing.
The axis, sorry. Yeah. Right, because the extra radiation brings
of the
together faster.
Yes.
Fine.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, so to summarize, region 1 and region 2 put together, as long as the dark photon is lighter than 10 to the minus 11 eV, then we can somehow affect the neutron star merger. And the quantity we try to constrain is this alpha tilde prime. That's the comparison between the dark gauge coupling and the G Newton and the dark charge over the mass of the neutron star. And if we eliminate the number of particles in each part, we get this quantity. F is the fraction, the mass fraction of the dark matter in each neutron star. And M chi was the mass of the dark matter particle. Okay, so a few quick words about the mechanism to give the dark charge. So in this case, actually, asymmetric dark matter is our way to give dark charge of each neutron star. But as I said, there are other ways to give dark charge of the neutron star. For example, in some scalar tensor theories, there's this so-called the scalarization process. So during the merge process, the charge, scalar charge, can be acquired dynamically. And they give very similar signals as well. So in the beginning, when the separation is large, the dark charge, the scalar charge is small. And when the separation gets smaller, they actually induce the scalar charge dynamically. But they have very different origins, as I have shown. So they cover a different parameter space. Because in the asymmetric dark matter case, as you have pointed out, that we need to worry about the accumulation and the history of the neutron star and things like that. Okay. Okay. So.
Just one quick
yes.
comment on that. I mean, depending on your assumptions about the scalar tensor theory,
yep.
the charge doesn't have to turn on at a critical separation. So in the second paper you cite,
yes.
You know, we consider just a sourced. Scalar cloud that's always there.
I see.
It's just a property of neutron stars.
I see.
So it doesn't turn on, it just basically gives you a Yukawa potential in the dipole radiation.
I see. So but it's still massive, right? The force carrier
is massive.
Right, right.
But it's choose your mass. It's whatever.
I see. Okay, thank you. Okay, so right, so for this, as I said, alpha tilde prime, that's equal to 1. That's basically the trivial bound. So if it's larger than 1, you cannot accumulate more dark matter for each dark particle. It's repelled away. And for for this analysis, it's the follow-up by other groups. We didn't do the analysis ourselves. So for this plot, basically, they consider, this is not very clear. They consider the bound of G prime at the fraction of dark matter separately. So I believe the horizontal axis, that's the G prime. And the vertical axis, that's the fraction of dark matter. So.
And alpha prime?
Sorry.
Alpha prime, what?
Fractional.
The alpha prime is the combination of the fraction of dark matter and the coupling.
Wait, alpha prime or alpha prime tilde?
Alpha prime tilde.
What
yeah.
is alpha prime? Is it the same?
Sorry. Quantity? Yeah. It's a typo.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So in this analysis, one thing that you do can see is the dashed curve.
Can I ask a very
yes.
more basic question? So if you have to assume there is an additional interaction between the dark matter and the neutron star, so that the dark matter stays put.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you modify the force between the the two neutron stars? Forget about the emission of quadruple emission. What about the trajectory of the two neutron stars? I mean, there's the trajectory.
That's region one.
Sorry,
that's region one. Yeah, that's in there. That's already more.
That's part.
Oh, okay, fine. Yes.
I see. So the simple punchline is, I see. So the plots are.
So
the plots are the plots, but the simple punchline from your analysis is alpha prime tilde less than a third.
Yes.
That was the outcome of your whole
analysis. Right. That's the analysis.
You do this whole thing, you look
exactly
at the LIGO data, and you go boom, less than a third.
Right. And for the fourth bound, that's less than one because
for the what bound?
For the fourth, for the trivial bound, for the monopole bound, let's see. If we only consider the repulsive force compared with the gravity bound. If this is equal to one, then that's a force bound, right? You cannot accumulate more particles to it. So my point is that this is smaller than one, so this is still not violating the force bound. You can accumulate dark matter particle to it, okay, rather than repel them away.
I see.
Okay, so this bound, I mean, that's the enhancement. Without doing all this analysis, you know that this is smaller than one. But after doing this analysis, we know that this is actually stricter than the force bound.
Okay. Sorry, like, this depends on like how much dark matter you have inside
F.
the neutron star.
But that's F.
That's F.
Right.
That already contains the F in it.
Yeah, but like, you first have to get like a, like, so even if you assume like my neutron star cleans up everything as it,
okay,
even the progenitor, like there is a maximum amount you can have.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Like, and your interaction is repulsive.
Yes.
So that probably doesn't help. So it's. Well,
you are worried about the accumulation process.
Yeah. So how much can you get if you assume everything that touches it is a capture?
Right. So.
Is that going to be enough? Fraction.
Well, we did check that part, and in order to accumulate enough dark matter, this either needs to be a little bit on the in the heavier end.
Right. Heavier.
Yes,
for
but like the density doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the mass density doesn't. The total mass you encounter doesn't depend on like the mass of the dark matter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, that's right.
So why does it depend on the mass?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the.
I mean, I guess the simple
reason.
Answer is the simple question that you're asking is, you know, neutron star lifetime times dark matter density times neutron star radius.
Yeah, that's
yes, right. So basically, the estimate was.
You need a lot of
right.
Well, but you need to increase the capture radius somehow.
I think like the more like is the star radius times the lifetime of the universe times the.
You mean this,
yeah,
right?
But the gravitational capture radius can be bigger than this. I mean,
yeah,
but it's a factor
like
of a few. Doesn't
yeah.
doesn't.
I mean, basically, you need to estimate times the lifetime.
Yeah.
Of
yeah.
the neutron star.
I can just
right.
take a geometric, right? You
yes.
Take
right. Take the geometric cross section and the.
How much?
Okay.
Can
so naively speaking, what if these neutron? What if your sense of the neutron stars, that are like forming in the middle of very massive halos with high dark matter density or something?
Well, that's a possible enhancement we did consider. I mean, in that case, then the accumulation is easier. But if we just take, for example, the local density of dark matter, then it is. A little bit non-trivial, but that's with. Sorry.
Like, what's the total? What's the mass fraction? Largest mass fraction you can get.
For that, I do not have a number on top of my head. But we did consider whether it's enough to generate this signal, and we saw there is enough parameter space to get this signal.
But how?
Sorry?
Like, what's the capture mechanism? Just geometric capture?
Yeah, just geometric capture.
In our galaxy or in other galaxies with more dark matter density?
You can get.
We assume that in a more dark matter dense environment.
Oh, okay. So you're not assuming ordinary cold dark matter density. How much more dense does it have to be?
Well, for that, I do not have an answer. I do not have, because I don't remember.
You're talking about halos. You're not talking about exotic dark matter densities. You're just talking about
no.
some crazy galaxy with a high dark matter density inside, right?
It doesn't have to be that high, actually. I mean, even with the local, even with our galaxy.
OK, so if you were to assume our local dark matter density, geometric 10 kilometers square cross section,
yes.
How much dark matter do you accumulate in the edge of the universe?
I think it's smaller than 1%. But I forgot.
So 10 to the, how
yeah, it's like 10 to minus 10 to minus 13. It's like 10 to 40 GB you can get.
Yeah, I think that's larger than that, no?
Well,
I don't have the number in my, on top of my head, but we did do that estimate.
Can we estimate it now?
Let's see.
For which dark matter mass?
Just,
like,
it doesn't matter. The number,
well, the number density, if you fix the energy density.
No, the mass density GeV over like centimeter cubed,
yeah,
times 10 kilometers squared.
Yeah.
Times the age of the universe, one
yeah,
age, right? That's my mass.
Yeah.
So here's a bit of information. Yes. One solar mass is 10 to the 57 GeV.
No, no, that,
yeah,
that's fine. But then the question is, how much is the fraction of?
So like, yeah.
So the flux of energy. So n sigma v is the rate of capture, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, if you multiply it by the mass, that's the rate of mass capture, which is independent by the mass of the particle. So if sigma is geometric, then it's a fixed amount independent of the mass,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
She fixed the conception.
So yeah, yeah. So this is how much?
So I get 10 to the 41, 42.
Yeah, so that's 10 to the minus 6.
That's what I'm
not. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
10 to the minus 42.
10 to the 42. 40,
so you get 10 to the 42. GeV
mm-hmm.
in a universe lifetime.
Okay.
And the mass of the sun is like
yeah,
57, right?
10 to
yeah,
57.
Yeah.
So you're
10
to minus, you're 60 matter order of magnitude off with local density.
Well, hang on. Let me
right. So, okay, now.
Now you need to find somewhere like to give you the 60 order of magnitude.
And it's linear in the density, so you need to have.
Yeah.
It's linear in the dark matter environment.
So I can but probably give you some like small fermions enhancement,
mm-hmm,
which might be like a factor of a solvent.
Yeah, right.
That's all the other.
No, I mean in that in the paper we did indeed we didn't quite consider the accumulation history and.
But then how is this important? Why are you placing an important bound if you're not considering the accumulation history?
So I mean the fraction is somehow as an assumption, like that we assume that there's a non-trivial accumulation through the history.
But how do you accumulate? You want to have, you have a very specific, you have a very specific model.
Uh-huh.
You,
I'm trying to independently
consider. You don't have, initially you're saying, okay, you don't want to have any standard model, additional standard model,
yes,
dark matter.
Mm-hmm.
How, so then the question is how does dark matter accumulate on the neutron star?
Right.
This is a simple question. Gravitationally, you can calculate. Assume you lose energy through photon emission.
Uh-huh.
Gravitational capture, the gravitational radius of the neutron star,
mm-hmm,
maybe it's a few times, I mean, factor of 10 bigger than 10 kilometers,
mm-hmm,
but it doesn't buy you the 16 orders of magnitude you need. It
could be that you need an extra interaction. So in the WIMP,
yeah, actually,
to get
we.
In the sun.
But how? You need to increase the capture radius. Somehow
yeah,
the effective cross section
mm-hmm
has to become, in order to get a factor of. Of like from 10 to the 6, you are at 10 to the minus 16, right? Of the fraction of the mass of the neutron
yeah
star. So you need to gain at least, let's say you're talking about a 1% fraction. So you need to gain 10 to the 6 in the range.
Sorry, I don't think, yeah, for this effect, it doesn't have to be as large as 1%. I mean, we did check 1%. But in the end, we also checked if it's much smaller than 1%, it's still significant.
Yeah, how small can you get?
You mean for F?
Yes. You will see an effect.
For F, I'm remembering that this is like still not as small as 10 to the minus 16. But it could be like closer to, I'm trying to recall, 10 to the minus 7 or 8 in that range. Yeah, but still, yeah, I agree. For the, we did notice this problem because for the local density, then it's not enough F for this to be bounded for the G prime.
Okay.
So assume that extra mechanism has to kick in to help
what
the accumulation.
Extra mechanism?
It could be like local fluctuation of the density.
By a factor of 10 to the 8?
It can't be all of that, I agree.
Okay, so then how do you get it?
For that, I don't know. For the accumulation, yeah, it's we started with the assumption, but we didn't notice that the local density does not address the accumulation for that. So in that sense, we are not putting a bound itself on G prime, because if we know the fraction, we can put a bound on the G prime.
Well, then what are you constraining then?
We are constraining the G prime and the fraction of dark matter inside the neutron star. So for example, that there are studies where they assume, for example, a 5 or 10% of the mass of the neutron star to be comprised of dark matter. And here, we are trying to say that it can't be the case. We are constraining.
I mean, but it cannot be the case because you cannot accumulate enough dark matter. Isn't that enough to kill it?
Well, I mean, the accumulation mechanism is something that we haven't, people haven't come up with.
Okay.
But we are trying to put in the bottom-up approach, we try to see from the gravitational wave data, what is the bound of the dark matter fraction?
Bottom-up approach. I mean, what is the mechanism that puts the dark matter there in the first place? I mean, you can assume heated mm-hmm. dragons, but if you cannot get it there,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's enough to exclude the possibility. Dark matter cannot accumulate in the neutron star.
But I think there are always ways to, I mean, I agree, I don't know that.
Do you know? I mean, I'm asking if a concrete clue. You say there are ways.
Mm.
What is the way?
For that, I don't know.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So, all right. Since I'm a particle physicist, I tend to write everything in terms of natural units, and I tend to draw everything in Feynman diagrams. This is a cartoon. So what I showed you about the signal is that without a dark sector, for pure gravity, we have a neutron star merger. They interact through gravity, and they radiate graviton, and we observe the time evolution of the graviton. And what I just described is that suppose that they interact also through the extra channel, through the dark photon, then it changes the time evolution of the gravitational wave. And besides that, we also consider the radiation, the dark radiation. And because of the extra radiation, it also changes the time evolution of the gravitational wave we observe. And to put it a step further, we also ask the question, can we generate gravitational wave through clumps of dark matter directly? And since gravity is always additive, in order to have strong enough gravitational wave signal, we need to build the dark large enough for the dark matter clump. And that leads to the second half of the talk. All right, so in cosmology, we know there's this Korczak problem, which is the discrepancy between the numerical simulation and the observation. And it boils down to that at a smaller scale, we don't really know the dynamics well of the dark matter. Of course, there are ways to fix it if we add feedback and some extra channel. But this is one of the problems. And another one is the so-called baryonic Tully-Fisher problem. With a few simple assumptions, we get the baryonic mass proportional to the velocity to the third. This velocity is the tail of the rotation curve. But for observation, we get mass proportional to the viral velocity to the fourth, with actually very little scattering for different types of galaxies. While none of this is concrete examples about beyond lambda CDM, but it does show us that we do not fully understand the dynamics well. So we have talked about the dark photons and fermion dark matter. Now let's look at dark scalars. There are a class of theories that claim that they can address the baryonic Tully Fisher problem and also the core cusp problem with a very simple potential. So if we look at the simplest potential of the scalar interaction, we write down phi to the fourth interaction, and we consider the boson-Einstein condensate of this system. So if we write down all the renormalizable terms, we have the cubic interaction and the quartic interaction. But since we are looking at the boson-Einstein condensate system, in this case, when the velocity is small, we can contract the cubic interactions and absorb it into the quartic interaction. So for the moment, let's only worry about phi to the fourth interaction. And by dimensional analysis, we can form boson-Einstein condensate clumps out of these light scalars of mass, the m Planck square over m. Because that if you form the boson-Einstein condensate, it essentially is the kinetic energy balancing against gravity. And kinetic energy is just by order of magnitude, is 1 over m.
Why?
Of the order of 1 over m.
Units don't match.
Sorry? What's wrong with that?
Natural
units. It's in natural units.
No, so you say kinetic energy is of order 1 over m.
Yes.
Those units don't match.
Yeah,
kinetic energy has
natural,
to
be m Planck squared over m.
It's m Planck squared over m. So basically,
why?
You have this.
P is of order m, not 1 over m.
Oh, no, I said, well, sorry.
You said 1 over m.
Yeah, I said the mass is proportional to 1 over m. But basically, you use this to balance gravity.
Yes.
So that you get, roughly speaking, the clump is m gravity square, m Planck square divided by m.
No, that's not. The mass is a free parameter. You can find minima for all masses.
Well, sorry, there's one piece I missed.
Yeah.
So you assume that it forms a boson-Einstein condensate so that everything is on the ground state. This whole thing can be described by a single wave function. Is
what is R?
This R is the width of the wave function. It will later be interpreted as the size of the clump.
Okay, but that's a free parameter.
Yeah, but because this is proportional, this 1 over R is basically the momentum of the particle.
Oh, you're assuming the particles are relativistic inside the clump.
Yes.
Why?
I mean, this is just a dimensional analysis. We assume that the momentum is of the order, same order of the
mass. Why does that have to, I don't understand.
Sorry, you don't understand that why it's relativistic.
Yeah,
because, okay, I'm going to show you that the relativistic correction is important in this case. So that's the whole point.
Why is this relativistic to start with? Dark matter in the galaxy is not relativistic. It's 10 to the minus 3. In fact, in the early universe, it has almost zero velocity, this phi field. So why is it relativistic?
Why does
is this a one dark matter story?
No, I think you collapse into something like that.
Yeah, then you collapse to a black hole.
When you collapse into the clumps, actually, the momentum of the dark matter is non-trivial, but it's confined within the clump.
No, there is a size r. So that equation, when you have a certain mass, when you try to find, you can find these clumps have ground state solutions.
Yes.
For every mass between, basically for every mass, it depends on what this r is. The r can be very large, the velocity is very small, or the r is of order 1 over m, and then you get something that's almost relativistic inside, then you collapse the black hole at some point. Now, so I'm saying what sets, there is one additional parameter that you guys are forgetting, which is the mass, the velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Why is the velocity 1?
It's not 1, because this is It could be, it could deviate. No, it could be deviate from, actually the real result is 0.5 something times this. Okay, I'm just doing a dimensional analysis.
No, but I'm telling you the velocity can be p, can be m times v, where v in the galaxy is 10 to the minus 3. So when
yes.
you calculate what the size is, it's 1,000 times. So when you calculate how much mass the equilibrium, so if you put velocity of 10 to the minus 3 there, then you would find a much different, I guarantee you.
Yes, but you cannot have a 10 to the minus 3 velocity to balance the gravity.
Why?
Because it's just not enough to balance the gravity. When it clamps,
I'll
the velocity is larger.
Some mathematics.
Okay.
So you can integrate that equation. You get an energy function as a function of the mass. So, so your kinetic energy goes like n, m r squared. This is the kinetic energy
yes.
term.
Yes.
Minus the self-interaction gravity term.
Yes.
G Newton. M squared over R.
Mm-hmm.
This has a minimum for all values of R.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So 1 over R, so that means that the velocity is a free parameter.
That's right. That's what we did the solution as well.
Okay, so but
right.
that's not the mean.
Well, this is just a dimensional analysis. It's of the same order.
No, it's not of the same order. So let's see. So the minimum is at point where these two terms are equal.
Uh-huh. Yes.
So then you get m r squared is equal to g Newton m r. Yeah, so this goes like g Newton. G Newton.
Times
n.
N. Yeah.
N.
Square.
Okay, yeah. So for this, you get that this is roughly the, so m times r
mm-hmm.
is basically, this is 1 over m times r is basically the velocity. So you get that the velocity inside there is one parameter, so this g Newton n m squared. So there is a solution. So depending on the velocity, even if this is 10 to the minus 3, there is still a self-consistent solution. So the size for that,
mm-hmm.
so let's take the solve for the mass. So this is V times M Planck squared over M. So there's a V here multiplying. Why is it of order M Planck squared? So V can be very small.
Maybe we had a look at that solution. So.
So the mass, so you equate, so there's an energy function you can write down.
All right, so the point is the size is not m Planck squared over m, it's v times m Planck squared.
Yeah. So there is a v, so it's not just
makes sense.
Yeah, so things are not necessarily relativistic.
Yeah, but I think for the clump to be of a few solar mass, this v is not that small, according to the numerical solution.
Depends on the mass. You can change what the mass, little m is.
Well, I can like make mass 10 to minus 22, and then like it's way bigger.
I mean, this can be.
I can have.
Yeah. But if you have for.
M, right? M is the mass of the.
Oh, the clamp. Yes.
Yeah, for the clamp, M is 10 to minus 10 eV.
What?
For the clamp of the mass to be a few solar mass.
Yeah.
Then, based on the numerical solution, we need a particle mass that's about 10 to the minus 10 eV.
Why? You can have.
Can I have lighter?
Yeah, why can you have
lighter? Why can't I not have lighter particles? Velocity. Fluffy object.
Yeah.
Of course, the fluffy object will be teared apart when it emits gravitational wave. But in principle, you can.
We are only considering the new the spherical symmetric solution.
But that's very symmetric. I'm not assuming any spherical
like
symmetry.
Yeah, the galaxy.
The little m is the mass per particle, right?
The little m is the fundamental particle mass, and n is the number of particles that you have in the thing. N times big n times little m is the mass of
right.
the clamp.
So maybe the statement is the following, okay? Because if I change little m to be the particle multiplicity and the mass of the thingy itself, then I get like m clump. So really, the size of the halo is v times n times m Planck squared over the mass of the clump,
yeah.
over the mass of the clump, right? And maybe what you're saying, I mean, I'm trying to understand, what you're saying is you want an M clump that's big enough to give you something interesting in terms of gravitational wave. Is that a fair thing to say, that you want an M clump that is sort of gravitational wave, solar mass size? Is that the target to get some gravitational wave signals for some reason?
Yes, indeed. So for this part, we want them to be around like solar mass.
Okay, fine. So that means that you have
square.
The size of the microscopic size is you know, V times N times M Planck squared divided by solar mass. Yeah?
Yeah.
Right? So now
you constrain V over M, but it's not the mass doesn't have to be.
No, I know, but I'm trying to say maybe I'm trying to understand, right? Because if you want a gravitational wave signal, you need the thing to be reasonably compact
that's
and reasonably heavy.
Yeah.
So maybe in that region of parameter space,
yes.
Maybe in that region of parameter space, with you, where you get a gravitational wave signal by being massive and compact.
I see.
Yes, that's right.
Regime.
That's right.
V maybe is reasonably large.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a way to see this.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mm. Okay, so why don't we keep going? I want to see the rest of this.
I would propose just to let him go to the ends.
No, because we were stopping for questions.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And
is that okay if we go
Yeah,
over time?
Of course.
Okay.
Because we were stopping you for questions, so it's fair.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah. All right, so just as a comparison, we are considering the boson stars and we're considering the fermionic system. Well, the fermionic system is a Pauli exclusion principle to balance against the gravity. Neutron star and white dwarf for this is essentially the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So it's the kinetic energy balancing against gravity. Okay. And the question really is, how compact can this object be? And that is very relevant in the context of LIGO. And okay, so this is the sensitivity band of LIGO in the region of a compactness versus the mass of the clump. Okay, so if we want to if we require the whole merge process to fall in this sensitivity band, that's between 50 hertz to 1,000 hertz, then we have this gray band. And okay, so this is dimensionless. This is in the unit of solar mass. And this is just the requirement for the frequency. We also have requirements for the amplitude, because if the signal is too faint, we cannot see, resolve the merger event. So that is the orange contour. And dl is the luminosity distance from the merger to us. If it's very far, then we need some very heavy and very compact stuff to be resolved. If it's closer to us, then we can resolve even fluffier and lighter stuff, lighter merger. Okay. This is a very biased list of the study. So actually, what caught our eyes was that when we were working on the stochastic background of the boson star mergers, we noticed that, and also we talked to Professor Gigi Fan, we noticed that in the early study, this is a solution of the numerical GR system. And this is a more recent study of the non-relativistic limit. Actually, there is a discrepancy between these two for the repulsive self-interaction case. If the scalar is repulsive, then according to this study, it has a maximal mass, which is actually far before it reaches the gravity band, which is compactness equal to 1/2. The clump actually, it stops growth way before it reaches 0.5 of the compactness. But in this case, because they are considering the non-relativistic limit, if they put in the self-repulsive interaction, phi to the fourth, they saw that the mass can grow indefinitely, which apparently is not true. But we want to understand, one, what is the reason that prevents the growth of these clumps? Two, why this non-relativistic limit, it doesn't capture the stop of the growth. OK, so in the first, the NR system, the non-relativistic limit, we have the Schrodinger equation. And it's in the boson Einstein state condensation. So it can be described by a single wave function. And because it's of macroscopic size, forget about the self-interaction for the moment. kinetic energy, and we need to put in the potential, which is the gravity potential. And in this system, the kinetic energy is proportional to wave function square, so it's proportional to the particle number. And the gravity potential, that's proportional to n square. That's not, it's not surprising that when the particle number grows larger and larger, this kinetic energy, it cannot balance the gravity, so that that's the limit of the maximum mass. Sorry? So this is just the kinetic system without self-interaction.
Yes,
and if we add self-interaction, then we add a phi to the fourth self-interaction, is proportional to n squared. And if it's attractive, it helps gravity. So actually, it clumps the it claps the system at early stage. So for example, it's well known that QCD axions, if even if we don't worry about the decay in the lifetime, it doesn't form dense enough, BEC system. But the interesting thing is that if this phi to the fourth is repulsive, it helps the kinetic energy, and it's also of n squared. It balances against the gravity. The question is, how dense can it grow, lead to for this BEC systems? If we solve this system numerically, we get these two curves. N is the particle number in a certain rescaled unit, so it's proportional to the mass of the boson star. This R90 is the radius that encloses 90% of the mass of the boson star. For the attractive case, for the attractive interaction, we get this curve. It has two branches, which I'm going to explain. So for the upper branch, at this moment, I'm just going to tell you that for the upper branch, that is the stable solution. And for the lower branch, it's unstable. And the funny thing happens for the repulsive case. If it's repulsive, then this profile grows indefinitely to the right. There is no maximal mass captured in this non-relativistic picture. This is Schrodinger-Newton picture. And now, if we put everything in the context of GR, and we write the Klein-Gordon equation in the curved spacetime, and we solve actually the metric, the background metric, together. So for the metric, of course, we are still in the spherically symmetric regime. And this is RR component and TT component. We promote them to a variable, a function. And we plug everything into the field equation. We get the so-called Einstein Klein-Gordon system. Roughly speaking, the first two equations, they are the equation of motion for the metric system. And for the last equation, that reduces to the flat space-time Klein-Gordon. So if we solve this system, we can we get even for the repulsive phi to the fourth interaction. There are two branches, stable and unstable, and there's a maximal mass of the BEC system.
Does it distinguish stable from unstable? How is the system set up differently? Does it have more rotational kinetic energy or something?
Okay. So for the stable system, if you perturb it in the particle number, then it's stable. It doesn't collapse. For the unstable, if you collapse it, if you perturb it, it collapses with respect to time.
I mean, right. I know what stable
means. You want to know the reason? I'm going to show you the reason why.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank
you. Right. That's what I'm going to show. Okay. But before I show you the stable versus unstable, so this is the what the Einstein Klein-Gordon system gives us in the context of LIGO. So for the BEC clumps, we can form actually the clumps as heavy as a few solar mass. And these labels, they are the label of the self-interaction. So it's 1 over this is the self-interaction. So if we crank up the self-interaction, they can form actually more heavier clumps.
Okay. Is this repulsive here?
Yes, this is repulsive.
Okay, so you're assuming it's repulsive.
Yes.
So just understand the assumptions here. So I understand, so this is actually, I mean, maybe for people that know gravitational waves, this is simple, but this is actually a very nice plot because it's sort of, I don't know that much about gravitational waves, so this helps me understand. It makes sense that compactness and mass is some sort of parameter space in which LIGO can see things.
Right.
And these lobes are different distances that you're sensitive to. So that's very helpful. So now I know what LIGO can see. So now what you're telling me is, let's imagine two boson stars merging. Is that what's going on?
Yes, this is the sensitivity band of the of two exotic compact objects.
Okay, so merging. Two
yeah.
boson stars, two exotic compact objects.
Yeah.
And literally, the 50 is the and 10 and 5 is like the self-attracting lambda, like 1 over 50, 1 over 10, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, what are the masses of the bosons? And what?
Okay, sorry. For all these three curves, we assume the bosons to be 10 to the minus 10 eV.
All right. And then along these curves, presumably what I'm changing is the mass of the boson stars. The total mass of the boson stars, right?
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, before I marked these dots, so everything to the left, that's the stable solution. So to the right, you can forget about it at this moment. That's the unstable solution. So if we only look at the curves here and here, they correspond to different size of the clumps.
And also different mass. I mean, size and size. Yeah,
of course, the size is yes. Yes.
Together. So what is the mass range that this sweeps out? If I take the blue curve,
yeah.
If I go from the dot all the way to the left, what is the mass range of the clump that you're sweeping out?
That's about 1 solar mass down to 0.3.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry. I see.
Yeah. So that's the mass of the clump.
Right.
Okay.
I see. Okay.
Right. All right. So a few observations, just to quickly. Sorry. Question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Quickly summarize what we have so far. So the first one is that the maximal mass. It only happens in the Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. And that's the 4GR. It is not captured in the non-relativistic limit. And it's not captured even in the Klein-Gordon system in flat space-time. So we think that this is related to the curvature, non-trivial curvature, of the background space-time, which is what I'm going to show next. OK, so in order to understand this system analytically, we put in exponential ansatz. It's not the best ansatz you can find for this wave function. But you know, it deviates in the center. But at large R, it's fairly OK, fairly good. If we plug in this wave function into the non-relativistic system, we get the Hamiltonian of the star. So this is the kinetic term, the self-interaction term, and the gravity term. For the attractive case, we can see that for a given particle number, okay, so this is what we expected, the gravity proportional to n squared, interaction proportional to n squared, and kinetic energy proportional to n. But there's another variable, that's the size of the star. Okay, and that is, roughly speaking, the momentum of the condensate system of each individual particle. So for a given particle number, if n is small, for example, here, we choose a small n, we get a curve like this. So this is the Hamiltonian of the star. So it has a local maximum and a local minimum. And this corresponds to one slice of here. If we choose a fixed n, so we have a stable solution and an unstable solution. It corresponds to these two local extremum. If we increase the particle number, then the local maximum goes to the right and local minimum goes to the left, they collide. And there we reach the maximal number of particles it can grow to. If we even increase n further, it doesn't have any local extremum. So there's no star solution in this region for the self-attractive case. And now we look at the self-repulsive case. We notice that the Hamiltonian structure is destroyed. Actually, it's no longer like this. It always has a local minimum. Therefore, in the NR system, it grows indefinitely. In order to fix this, we need to flip the sign of the Hamiltonian system as small r. And because this is to the 1 over r to the third, we have to have some effect of the same order or even larger. and this.
So the reason you do that is why? To capture the GR effects?
Yeah, we want to understand what limits the growth of the star system.
In the GR case?
In the GR case.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so the lessons we have learned that I have already said that. So for the way to understand these two terms is that for the gravity is more relevant in the long range case. So it's one proportional to 1 over r. For the self interaction, it wins at smaller scale. So it's 1 over r to the third. Right, I have already said this. And we want to have an effect that's proportional to 1 over r to the third, or even higher. And we want to see that this effect comes from the curvature. And for the energy density, we write them out. There are only two terms related to the metric. And in particular, for this term, this A actually grows larger than 1, than the flat space time. And 1 over A, that gives us a negative contribution to this system compared to the flat space time case.
A negative meaning tending to unstable. Negative attractive.
Yes, right. And we want to quantify whether this contribution from metric is proportional to 1 over r third. And now we, we put in another ansatz. This is the same ansatz of the exponential function. And now we also put ansatz for the metric perturbation in the weak gravity limit. And we integrate over the energy density. And skip some details. We want to see what extra term it gives us. And voila, it's indeed we recover all the non-relativistic terms plus an extra term that's proportional to n squared and also r to the third. And this is related to the r component of the curvature effect. So this is the reason that even for the repulsive self-interaction, it stops before the compactness reaches 1 over 2, the black hole limit. And we put.
If I make f very small, then the 1 over r cubed term will always dominate.
Well,
the positive thing will always dominate.
You are considering like increasing the self interaction.
Yeah.
For the self, if we, we also thought about that. If we increase the self interaction, actually this ansatz breaks down. The difference between the ansatz and the numerical solution is quite large. It cannot, it can no longer be captured.
Matter, but the ansatz will change you is the coefficients of these terms.
Well, the ansatz itself is a small f approximation. Is that the way to say it?
It's a large f.
A large
f. A small interaction approximation.
So this analytical intuition is not applying, presumably,
right,
if f is small.
Right. If we lower f, the interaction gets large, and the shape of the wave function is distorted quite a lot.
But I mean, I guess the question remains that if you just make repulsion strong enough,
then why shouldn't
that make an arbitrarily large puffy cloud?
Yeah, by this argument, because the scale is the same. What the ansatz changes is not the scaling of these terms; it changes the coefficients of these terms.
The reason that this ansatz doesn't apply for a stronger interacting case is that instead of having a exponentially decaying profile, it has a centrally peaked value here, and then it dies down with a long tail.
So it doesn't go to 0 to infinity?
It does, but it goes to 0 much slower than the weakly interacting case.
So if I were to calculate the average size, let's say I were to calculate the size of the wave function.
Okay.
Would it still be, where is most of the support, where is most of the stuff is? So if I were to calculate, so where is most of the mass? What is the R of 90%? For that case,
for
the self-interacting case,
for the strongly self-interacting.
Yeah, strongly self-interacting.
I would say, okay, so for based on the numerical computation, the R90 is in the tail, not in the center. It's somewhere here. And for the weakly interacting case, R90 is somewhere here, but it encloses more mass in the center. So there are more mass here compared to the mass enclosed here. Therefore, if we crank up the self-interaction, actually, the compactness up to a value, it decreases because of the distortion of the wave function. So it cannot hold enough mass, so to speak. So the wave function distortion lowers the mass contained in it with a longer tail. Okay. All right. Okay, so quickly. Summarize, this is the Bose-Einstein condensate can be compact if the self-interaction is repulsive. This is well known. And we observe that actually what limits this compactness is the damping effect because of the back reaction of the space-time curvature. It makes the kinetic energy not as effective as in the flat space-time. Okay. All right. So. One last small point is that okay, I have gone through the other cases, three cases. Let's look at the axion-like particles. We know that the light scalars, they are very dangerous in effective field theory unless there's some extra symmetry protecting it. But we also know that for the QCD potential, it gives us a attractive leading self-interaction. So it's not compact enough, even if we make it form BEC system. So one of our collaborators, she looked into cases where we can generate repulsive self-interaction while in a fairly natural context. And we can actually have multiple cosine potentials. And when we play with the charge of this extra U1, we can form a positive M square and the positive lambda to the fourth interaction. And
what is lambda to the sixth?
Sorry, this one? This is the subleading term, the phi to the sixth interaction when we expand it.
Does it, yeah, it doesn't matter. Does it have, because in the axions it switches sign, right? It
yes.
Alternates, so.
Right.
Here it's still repulsive. Does it have the same sign as lambda to the fourth?
Yeah, this is positive and this is positive.
Okay.
But if we only have two cosine potentials, actually the subleading term is attractive. There's no way to make this still positive.
I see. This
okay.
is what I was asking.
Yeah, okay. I guess you were thinking about this.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So actually we showed that with two cosine potentials, it's an algebraic exercise. There's no way to make this is also positive.
Okay.
And actually that leads to the very last point of my talk. So if we only consider approximation to the phi to the fourth leading interaction, we actually lose some information of the potential. And if we consider the full potential, it is very non-trivial in the context of the star formation, the boson star system. So for the dash curves, that's the same curve I showed you with the phi to the fourth interaction. And if we consider the full potential, which reproduces the phi to the fourth interaction in the leading term, we get the solid curves. And they are quite different, and it's because of the nonlinearity associated to the full potential.
By the way, have you checked the lifetime of these guys?
For the lifetime, we are not coupling this to the visible sector, so that.
So the lifetime will be dominated by, I guess, for gravity. So what happens when you have there is a coordinate. Are you assuming all of them are real fields?
Yes.
So there is 3-to-1 annihilation.
Yeah. So you're thinking about actually.
Yeah.
4-to-2, right?
No. 3-to-1.
But this is not conserved in momentum.
Yeah. What? No. Why? Why is it not conserved?
How can you get three particles
even
to get?
In the background, yeah, there is no fixed momentum for this.
Well, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure.
So and these particles are relativistic. So why does this particle survive till day. So how does the lifetime vary across those curves for that? Because you're considering very compact objects.
Yes. Because for this Hamiltonian is actually a function of two parameters, particle number and the shape.
Yeah.
And we checked that there's no way to change the particle number numerically without changing the shape of the wave function.
No, that's not, what are you talking about?
So
R is not a fixed momentum. I mean, there is
no, it's not.
So there's no fixed momentum. So there is a non-trivial source term in the Klein-Gordon equation. There is non-trivial source 3:1. So the solutions that you find in another non-relativistic regime, so those conserve automatically particle number.
Yes, that's right. I see what you mean. In the relativistic regime, it's not conserved.
Yes.
And
you have velocities, the compactness so high, the velocity inside the clamp is order one.
Yes, that's right.
So there's no suppression in the process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't check the lifetime myself, but I know that Rohana and Josh Abbey, they did check that this process and the lifetime of the clump. And it turns out that, yes, I think they have.
For axions, I know for the clumps that are very relativistic, the lifetime is 1,000 times it's 1,000 times 1/n.
But these things don't have derivative couplings, right?
No, they don't have derivative couplings.
This is just a phi to the, yeah. So this is just the this interaction.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So why? Yeah, I'm confused.
Yeah, I didn't check this myself, but I think their claim is that they can live long enough to survive until today.
And be compact enough?
Yes.
Can be. See, what is the reference?
So actually it's in one of the papers. Let's see. It's not this paper, but another paper, they talk about the collapse of the system.
Okay. Talk about what?
The collapse of the BEC system.
Forget about the collapse. This is not a collapse. This is a process that's...
You're just considering the number changing process.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. If we have something here with the number changing, it moves up.
Yeah.
It becomes a fluffier.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, continue.
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
We lose this room already.
Oh, okay.
Okay, all right.
Until 3.
Okay, I think I'm... No.
Let's finish, because we've asked you too many questions.
Yeah.
No, I think this is the last page before the summary. Okay,
okay.
I'm down.
Okay, so we're done, okay.
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 All right.
Yeah.
Let's thank then Shen.
Okay.
All right, thank you for all the questions.